Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. While Japan struggles with simple survival and an all-too-real nuclear threat after the quake, the country's next challenge is already standing clear and tall, and it's economic. Factories are down, roads broken, energy supply a mess, and this in the world's third-largest economy. This hour on Point, we're looking at the quake's economic impact in Japan and across the world. You can join the conversation. What do you see coming? A bounce back, a setback, a blow to global economic recovery? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. A special welcome today to our newest listeners on 88.5 WFDD in the Winston-Salem, Greensboro, High Point area. Great to have you with us. Joining me first today from Tokyo, Japan, is Ken Belson, correspondent for the New York Times. Ken, thank you very much for joining us. What's the latest on the nuclear plant, Ken?
Well, it was another explosion today around midday Tokyo time, which led to yet more fears of irradiated particles spreading around the country. The winds, thankfully, were blowing away from Tokyo today, so that spared some of the anxiety in the city here. But the fact that the electric company in charge doesn't have is still struggling with this suggests that there's still a ways to go. There was footage around midday here also of helicopters flying in giant buckets of water, essentially, with chemicals in them, flame retardants or some sort, dropping them on the reactor to douse it, I guess. A very odd sight to see a giant helicopter dumping water, and it suggests that something of a last-ditch effort.
If that's a last-ditch effort, and it doesn't seem it was all that effective, what's the concern here, Ken, if this really goes all the way to full meltdown, if they can't find a way to get a handle on it, what are the potential implications?
Well, obviously, thus far, some of the particles released have been ones, perhaps, if you will, a little more benign, but a full meltdown has the potential for some of the more toxic elements to be released into the atmosphere, and obviously that not only affects people breathing now, but gets into plants and other things that can stay in the ecosystem for a lot longer. And obviously, I don't know the impact about radiated clouds moving across the Pacific and how much of it dissipates over time. There's a certain amount of that going around anyway. But there's such a vast ocean between Japan and the rest of America that I don't think that's an immediate impact, although some people think it perhaps is.
But for Japan itself, is there talk of, there's already been a big evacuation around the nuclear plant. Is there talk of evacuation plans more broader than that, even Tokyo or not?
There are people leaving, particularly the expats who, you know, have less reason to be here and perhaps more wherewithal to get out. There is some reports of Japanese leaving as well, but I think, frankly, most people at this point are actually just staying home because the trains are not running as regularly as they normally do, and some businesses have sort of ground to a halt because not everybody's able to get into the office, and that has allowed people just to stay indoors, sometimes with instruction from others, depending on how far you are from the actual nuclear plants in question. And some people are just nervous, and perhaps justifiably so. There's still a lot of aftershocks here in Tokyo, and that sort of rattling nerves, none as large as the gigantic quake the other day, but no reason, you know, it's still a reason very much for concern.
Ken, with the huge initial quake and then the tsunami and now the nuclear threat, I think it's hard for people outside of Japan to get a handle on just how shut down the country is. Can you paint a picture for us? Are there parts of the country, big parts, operating absolutely normally? How much of it is paralyzed at this point?
That's a good question. I mean, Tokyo, perhaps like London in England and Paris in France, is undeniably the center of the business world in this country. All the major corporations, the bureaucrats, the media industry is all centered here. And so anytime Tokyo shuts down, the country has to, by almost necessity, follow. The area that was most stricken by the tsunami is mostly an agricultural area, though there are a lot of, for example, electronics assembly plants and some auto manufacturing, but it's really not the industrial heartland. And so, you know, parts of the country are existing perfectly fine. Areas down in Osaka, Nagoya, south of Tokyo, are not affected pretty much at all. The trouble now is really just the transportation network. Some of the bullet trains are shut down. Many of the highways are impassable. And when it comes to things like agricultural products, fish, milk, other things that normally are brought in from the northern part of the country, that's having trouble getting here. And so you're seeing, you know, then mixed with some panic buying, you know, some of the stores are picked clean of some of the essential foods. So it's a mixture of a lack of inventory and some panic buying. But, you know, I lived in Japan for 12 years, and just coming back here after this earthquake, just amazed at how empty the streets are here in Tokyo. It's almost startling. The only times I saw the streets this empty were usually New Year's Day, you know, a national holiday. Yeah. You see so few people out in the street.
And this is right in the middle of a working week. We're reading about all kinds of factories and production shut down. What about energy? That's pretty crucial to making things run. Many nuclear plants shuttered at this point. What is the energy supply situation as far as you've seen, Ken?
Yeah, well, there are rolling blackouts scheduled for usually three-hour intervals in different parts of the area in Tokyo and around Tokyo. It's actually a very large area. The particular problem, and I think most Japanese can do without power for 3 hours, whether it be during the workday or in the evening, as long as they know about it. The trouble is that the announcements about who is getting blacked out at what hour are sporadic and hard to follow, and so people don't know whether to hop on the train and come to work because perhaps the train won't be running when they go home at night. And that level of confusion is really kind of dastardly in the sense that people just want predictability, and unfortunately right now it's hard to get that. And some of it you can understand given the circumstances is unavoidable, but it also kind of smacks of a government kind of making it up as it goes. And that's unnerving, too, and it's kind of eroded people's confidence a bit. I met several businessmen today, both foreign and local, who said, you know, I can't even go to sales meetings because the other party isn't there, and who wants to talk about sales right now? Everybody's sort of in hunker-down mode.
Empty streets, unreliable energy, unpredictable future at this point. Ken Belson in Tokyo, Japan, with the New York Times. Thank you very much for being with us, Ken.
Thanks, Tom.
Our thoughts, of course, with all the Japanese people whose lives have been upended in this earthquake and its aftermath, and, of course, with the entire country. We're looking today at the economic implications of this for Japan and for the world. Joining us now from Washington is Marcus Noland. He's Deputy Director and Senior Fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, expert on Asian economies. Marcus Noland, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure to be with you, and I would like to extend my greetings to your new listeners in my hometown of Greensboro, North Carolina.
Great.
It's very clever of you to book me on this morning.
Oh, well, we like to do just that way. Also with us today, all of our welcome there. Also with us today from East Lansing, Michigan, is David Griffith, professor at the Michigan State University Business School. He's been focused for years on Japan's economy. David Griffith, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom. It's my pleasure to join you.
The whole world is watching as Japan wrestles with this nuclear threat. What do you see going on there? Is this a bounce-back situation in Japan where the rebuilding itself will rebuild the economy? If this nuclear threat worsens, is it going to be that simple, David?
Well, I don't think it's that simple, Tom. I think that what you're seeing is you're seeing a real shift in Japan right now and a shift in the world economy. There's a potential change with the economic situation in terms of the level of debt that Japan has already created, and you're looking at adding to that, which will put them well over close to 223% their GDP. That's going to create additional challenges if they don't start addressing issues such as their immigration policy and how they actually address business within their own marketplace.
Well, you're going right to immigration and really big issues. Marcus Noland, what do you know, first of all, about what's already closed down. I mean, we're reading this litany of factories that are closed. There are 45% of Toyota's global production shut down at the moment. You know, scores of factories closed. What is the sort of toll, the litany at this point, Marcus, that you're aware of?
Well, the basic issue is that there's certainly going to be permanent impairment of assets in the immediate region of the earthquake. The real issue is how long or how sustained are these shutdowns in areas that Ken mentioned, you know, well outside of the earthquake zone down in the Kansai region. And we're less than a week into this. And I think that the key issue, I think that there are two basic uncertainties. One is, do you get another aftershock in a large population area? And obviously, we hope not. Or if you get another aftershock that worsens the nuclear situation up in Tohoku. Secondly is this issue of the networks, the disruption of the power grid and the transportation network. And I think Ken put his finger exactly on the correct issue. If the rolling blackouts are predictable, people can work around them. Anybody who's lived in a third world country can tell you this. And people can adjust pretty quickly, as businesses can. But if these disruptions remain unpredictable for a sustained period of time, then yes, the negative shock of that earthquake up in Sendai could be propagated throughout the Japanese economy, and then it has much more implications both for Japan and the world. The other thing, of course, is I think that something that Ken indicated, what I hope we would get back to, is the issue of the government's response and how that will be viewed by the Japanese voters and the long-run implications this could have for Japanese politics.
Hold the thought. We will come to it and much more. We're looking at Japan's economy and the global economy after the quake. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today as Japan struggles with the aftermath of the big quake and tsunami and ongoing nuclear threat there. And our thoughts with all the Japanese who are still very much in the midst of that struggle. We're looking at Japan's economy and the global economy after the quake. The future of those Japanese struggling right now will very much depend on how much, how quickly can be brought back. The whole world has an interest in this as well. Marcus Nolan joins us today from Washington, D.C. He's a deputy director, senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. From East Lansing, Michigan, David Griffith is with us from Michigan State University. He's been looking at Japanese business for a couple of decades. David, I want to come to you on exactly what you're hearing about how things are right now. I mean, we heard from Ken, empty streets in Tokyo, rolling blackouts, still this big nuclear threat. How much of production is shut down in Japan, and what does it mean at this point about people's incomes, their daily lives? Will they have paychecks, food to eat, means to live by?
Well, I think that the immediate aftermath, you know, you saw Honda, Mazda, Toyota, Nissan, Mitsubishi, Fujitsu, Heavy Industries, Shin-Etsu, and Sumoko all shut down facilities immediately. I mean, mm-hmm. Corporations in Japan are most closely concerned right now with the families of their employees and making sure everything is taken care of. So while I don't have direct knowledge of whether or not they will be paid or not, it has always been a history of Japan to take care of their employees. I think what we're doing now is we're kind of seeing what the extent is over a short period of time and whether or not we can get some of these plants back online. So Shin-Etsu, which is one of the leading companies in semiconductor production, it closed its plants immediately, but it's also restarted yesterday the Gunma facility. But the Shirakawa facility is going to be out of operations for some time due to damaged equipment.
Marcus Noland, there was a huge quake, of course, in Kobe, 16 years ago or so now. Japan recovered very, very quickly from that. If you look back, it's hardly a blip. It was huge, a lot of suffering at the time, enormous global attention, but Japan bounced right back, effectively. What about this time? Can we expect something similar? Take a blow, struggle. We've seen the terrible destruction there, but the economy reviving in the rebuilding itself, in effect.
Well, as I indicated, there are two sources of uncertainty. And so one has to be very careful about making direct comparisons to the experience in Kobe. If you get an aftershock that really worsens the nuclear situation, or if you get an aftershock in a major population area like Tokyo, then this could just become completely qualitatively a different experience. But if the disaster remains in some sense a conventional natural disaster, then yes, I think we have to expect that Japan will rebuild. David mentioned that they have a lot of government debt. And the figure that he mentioned, over 200% of GDP, is a factually accurate figure. But I think it's also a misleading one. About half that debt is held by one Japanese government entity against another, oftentimes backed up with assets such as toll roads that generate real economic returns. So if you look at the net figure, it's much lower. It's about 100% of GDP. Not good, admittedly starting from a weak position, but it's not twice national income. And 95% of that is held by residents of Japan. And they are much less likely to be footloose than, say, hedge fund managers would be. So the government of Japan has a lot more room to maneuver. It has a lot more leeway in terms of rebuilding Sendai than many other governments in the world would have in similar circumstances. So I think there's no question that the immediately affected areas will be rebuilt, and I think they'll be rebuilt pretty rapidly, assuming that there's no major change in the nuclear situation. The real issue to me, the real long-run issue, is whether this is a shock that changes the rules of the game in Japanese politics. As Ken mentioned, you have a situation now where the government is put under a fair amount of attention. This, and in Japan, we've had one political party, the Liberal Democratic Party, or LDP, rule almost continuously since the end of American occupation. Right now, you have the sort of novice opposition party, the Democratic Party of Japan, governing. If they do a good job, this will reassure voters that they are for real. They represent a real alternative to the LDP, and you could cement a two-party system in Japan. If they do badly, if this is Japan's version of Hurricane Katrina, then I think that the voters will flock back to the LDP, and this will send Japan back into its past rather than into its future.
Which could what does define this as a really interesting moment in Japan's path forward. Marcus, what about, given Japan's debt, and I mean, this is a country I know well. I lived for 5 years in Japan. My heart is just breaking as I see these images. These are very hardworking and industrious people, but you've got to have the capacity and resources to rebuild. Is that debt, will it be a break on the rebuilding in Japan? You know, will they be under constraint because of the debt that's accumulated there in recent decades? Or do you see them fully free to rebuild when things finally get clear, this nuclear issue, we pray, finally gets settled?
Well, they have one of the reasons that they're in the debt problem that they're in now is decades of absolutely wasteful expenditure. As you or me or David or Ken, anybody who's lived in Japan knows, for decades, public investment was very wasteful due to the disproportionate impact that these lightly populated rural districts had on national decision making. So you had multi-million-dollar bridges to nowhere. You had roads being built with very little traffic. You had bullet trains going through rural areas. You had small fishing villages getting expensive modern port facilities. So the government has some capacity simply to redirect away from these white elephant projects and into a much more socially useful endeavor of rebuilding Sendai. So part of this rebuilding can simply be shifted from other forms of expenditure. And then at the margin, I think, as I said, this government has a lot more room to maneuver than many governments around the world would have. I don't think Japanese residents are going to start dumping their government bonds if the government stands up and says, we're going to spend some extra money rebuilding the city of Sendai.
This is because of the sort of culture of Japan, that the money will stay, will be focused there, will be plowed back into their own economy.
Absolutely.
Let's hear from Tsukuyo calling from Boston. Tsukuyo, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
This is my first time calling. I love your show. It's really informational. I receive lots of information. I'm citizen of Japan, and right after I heard the news of the tsunami, I immediately worried about the plant situation. But government deliberately downplayed the situation so that the the citizens have, even till now, don't have any idea how dangerous it is. And all this foreign press reports the accurate information, and one person who did the conference, the foreign correspondent club in Tokyo, the Goto Masashi, he was the actual plant. He was the person who actually designed the plant. He was in responsibility, so he knows the actual situation. So what he just said is that the at this point that this containment cannot hold, because that was
Well, we've seen all the damage to the plant. It's it would be surprising at this point if it can hold. It's not fully holding already. Do you have family in Tokyo, in Fukushima? Where in Japan?
I have, all my family are in Tokyo and in Ibaraki, which is like 100. It's very near to the Fukushima plant.
And what are you hearing from them? Are they worried about where to get food today? Are they worried about Japan's future at this point?
No. The thing is, the very strange thing is that I was for four straight days calling and sending email frantically to all of my relatives and my family and my friends, but no one really believes what I'm saying, like how critical the situation is. Even I'm saying about this press conference at the Tokyo Correspondents Club.
Wow.
But now, there was this critical blow, I think it was yesterday, but finally I was able to evacuate my parents. I bought the ticket myself, and I just ordered them to just take the plane. So I was able to evacuate my parents and also only one of my friends.
So they've left Tokyo. Have they left Japan now, Tsukuyu?
Yeah, they're now about to reach to Boston. So my husband is going to pick them up, but no one really understands how bad the situation is. For me, it's even worse than what happened during World War II. For me, I felt like this is like the end of the civilization. But no one really believed me, and that was the most astonishing thing. I explain all this article from NPR or BBC or where all this article, and even I transcribed a press conference.
Yes.
One word by one word, but no one really believed it, and that was the most frightening thing. And they just they first say thank you, and they want to brush me off, and because they really think that the information, and they think the press conference by the government is the correct information.
But now your parents are out, and we hope that they and all your family and many more Japanese besides will be safe. Tsukuyo, thank you very much for calling. David Griffith, do you have a sense that Japan itself, the Japanese people, are aware, fully aware, of the risks that they are now facing as this nuclear crisis continues to boil?
I'm hopeful that the Japanese government is providing the information that is accurate to their knowledge. But, with any government, it's important to also make sure that we take a cautionary tone, because the worst thing that can happen is actually to incite any type of panic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have seen that throughout the world economy in relationship to what's going on in Japan, is that some people have taken this as an opportunity to signal an alarmist tone, if you will.
Well, but on the other hand, if there's this always this difficult balance between honesty and potential panic here, especially when you come to nuclear issues.
I agree, Tom.
The sell-off in the Japanese market was more than 10% over the last couple of days. It's bounced back by about 5% today, but it was the biggest loss since 87 or so. Is that a sign of Japanese themselves, fearing very bad things in the economic future, or do you think that's just a momentary giant uncertainty in the face of this disaster, David?
I think what you saw in the 6% drop on Monday and the almost 11% drop on Tuesday was simply a reaction to the uncertainty that was in the marketplace. The Bank of Japan stepped in, injected liquidity of about $170 billion, which will be spread across Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And you saw the market come back almost 6% on Wednesday. A lot of people taking advantage of the lower stock prices in Japan. It's a buy opportunity.
And what about the Japanese government's indebtedness? We can argue about how to define the percent of GDP, but do you see any constraint on Japan's ability to borrow to rebuild? Or is it possible it could get stuck in a ditch here? It's had very low growth for a long time since its heyday in the 80s. Does it have the resources to rebuild?
I believe, you know, hearkening on Marcus's comment, the way that the debt is structured, although it sounds most alarming, that there's really not going to that be that large of a concern. And I think you're going to have a number of investors who are willing to place money on the table for rebuilding the third largest economy in the world.
Conrad in Omaha, Nebraska. Conrad, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hey, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, everybody's talking about how damaging this is going to be to the world economy, but couldn't this be a good thing for our economy in the short term?
In what way exactly, Conrad?
Well, manufacturing. Somebody's going to step up, fill the void. They're going to need steel to rebuild. They're going to need food. They're going to need supplies, you know. Couldn't we get our factories going into high gear again, hire some more people for a year, 2 years, 3 years, just get unemployment down for a while?
Let's talk about it. Conrad in Omaha, thank you. Marcus Noland, do you see a stimulus possibly for the rest of the world economy in helping Japan rebuild? Or even, I think Nolan's suggesting they're stepping in to arenas that where they may lose manufacturing capacity.
Sure. I think that there are some opportunities. But I think that the way this is going to play out, it's not so much that production is disrupted in Japan, and so the United States starts producing those products and shipping them to Japan in replacement. Rather, what's going to happen is there's production being disrupted in Japan. That's going to propagate through the rest of East Asia. We already see that now with issues arising in Thailand and other countries where they import components produced in Japan and fabricate them into finished goods that may be shipped to the United States or other locations. So the initial kind of replacement, so to speak, is probably going to be ramping up of production networks that may even be the same firms. It may be Honda or Toyota increasing production in areas that are not so directly dependent on specific factories that have been disrupted in Japan. It will be competitors in other countries that are not directly affected. And so there's going to be a bunch of shifting of production in response to this event. But until we know the precise contours of it, it's hard to predict. Now, in terms of direct effect on the United States in terms of exporting stuff to Japan, the one thing that you could point to is the whole uncertainty this has now created about the nuclear industry. There's possibly going to be a shift towards away from nuclear and towards other forms of energy in the medium run. And one of the big things we export to Japan is coal. So you could see an increase in exports of coal and other sorts of fossil fuels, not only to Japan, but to other locations in the world, as the nuclear industry comes under greater scrutiny.
David, you've talked about the supply chain issues here, the Japanese parts in so many products around the world. You're there in Michigan. What about U.S. automakers? Have they already seen some effect from what's going on in Japan?
I think we've seen some effect of all automakers in the U.S. just from the standpoint of the shipments they know will not be coming. So you have had some plants within the U.S. which have reduced the number of hours they're no longer doing overtime simply to make sure that they're conserving their inventory levels for a longer period. Because as Marcus has said, there's just no way to know right now how long this is going to last or what the overall supply situation may be. In the semiconductor industry specifically, even before this occurred, we were concerned about supply in the auto industry of silicon wafers.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we're talking this hour about the situation in Japan in particular, Japan's economy and the global economy after the quake. They will need to get some of that economy up and running. some more of it in order to rebuild after so much devastation, so much heartache and pain in that country. But it is not going to be an easy road. Today, in a very rare address to the Japanese people, the Japanese Emperor Akihito said that he was deeply worried about the crisis and nuclear crisis that that nation is facing. The emperor urged citizens, Japanese citizens, to remain hopeful and steadfast in the tough days to come. Here he is with some CNN translation.
I truly hope that we will be able to save lives and perhaps slightly improve the lives of victims. And hopefully with these efforts, we will be able to encourage victims and offer them hope as they try to recover.
A little bit there from a rare address by the Japanese emperor directly to the Japanese people. David Griffith joins us today from Michigan State University, a professor there who's been following the Japanese economy for a long, long time. Marcus Noland is with us from Washington and the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Let's get a call from Morgantown, Kentucky, and Eric. Hi, Eric. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I've had a little dealings with working with the Japanese here in the United States, obviously. They've pioneered a lot of technology for the earthquake systems and all that.
Yes.
And in the end, it may take a while, a decade or two, whatever, but I think they'll come out better on the other side because they'll take this opportunity to pioneer some tsunami, better understandings for that, and also nuclear reactors problems. I think they'll crack the code on it. I mean, it may take several decades, but the global industry of nuclear reactors are only come out better. The Japanese are perfectionists by nature. I mean, they don't build nothing 75%, 80%. They build it 100%. And when one of their reactors fail, I guarantee you they won't build another one until they fix this problem and move on. I mean, and that's my comment. I'll take it off there.
Eric, I appreciate your call, and we're glad for that note of optimism. This is an incredibly resilient people, David Griffith, and ingenious in so many ways, and yet they're up against something very big here. Do you share that confidence in Japan's resilience in the face of this challenge, David?
I do share Eric's confidence. I mean, you're looking at nuclear reactors that were built 40 years ago, mm-hmm. and they have, granted they've taken great damage, but you're looking at a 9.0 earthquake and a enormous tsunami, and they are still... they still have not breached at this point. And so I do think that, as Eric said, that, the Japanese people are perfectionists and they will move towards building better and safer technologies.
Well, let me ask you, Marcus, here's a comment on the website from Greg in Springdale, Arkansas. It says, Japan has been economically stagnant for a long time. That is true, since their big bubble in the 80s. It can recover its power grid and damaged areas, Greg writes, but can it ever return to the levels that it held years ago when everyone looked to it as a model? Marcus?
Well, probably not. The fact of the matter is the Japanese labor force peaked in 1998 and the population of Japan actually peaked a few years ago. So the demographics of the situation is this is a rapidly aging population with a shrinking labor force. So it's unlikely that it's ever going to grow at 4 or 5% again for a sustained period of time. But that's not to say, as one of the earlier callers indicated, it's not to say that they will not continue to produce very high quality, sophisticated, advanced technological products. And so would I expect to see Japan leading the world like maybe it did in the 1980s? No, the demographics are such that that just won't happen. But this is an economy and a society with a lot of capacity and a lot of resources. I was struck by one of your early callers saying that she thought it was the end of the civilization. My reaction watching television is that this has reaffirmed the strengths of Japanese societies. The other night, I was watching CNN, and the reporter was doing a segment from one of these relief centers, and they ran out of water. Mm-hmm. And the people were calmly waiting. And the reporter commented that he was surprised that they weren't rioting and carrying on. And I thought this said more about the mentality of an American journalist than it does the people of northern Japan. I think they've behaved in an exemplary manner.
Well, the cooperation is incredible to see. Japan is as a nation of survivors. I mean, they've known earthquakes and trouble for a long, long time. On the other hand, they've been competing right out on the very, very sophisticated front edge of the world economy. And that takes a kind of infrastructure that had been built over many decades, an infrastructure being pressed right now. John in Windsor, Vermont, thanks for calling, John. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Japan is one of the largest holders of U.S. treasuries in the world, I think maybe second after China. What happens, or what's the likelihood of Japan starting to dump U.S. treasuries, and what would be the effects of that?
It's a good question. David Griffith, if Japan needs to bring the money home to rebuild, what about, could there be, might there be a knock-on effect on other nations, the U.S. in particular?
There's a possibility at the rare outside chance that that would occur. I really don't see that I don't see Japan calling our debt.
But are they still big buyers of it? Even if they don't call what they already hold, will they be there to buy U.S. treasuries if they've got this enormous nation building to do, David?
Well, I don't know. I think it's a challenge for anyone to buy U.S. treasuries at the moment simply because of our debt situation.
What about other global knock-on effects, Marcus Nolan? I mean, Japan is primarily an export economy, not an import economy, so it's not a big center of demand for the rest of the world. Certainly, they buy things from abroad, but they export a whole lot more. Does that lessen the impact on the global economy, Marcus?
Well, a couple things. To get back to John's original question, sure, there's going to be some repatriation of funds. I mean, if not sort of a centrally directed idea that they're going to dump treasuries, but simply Japanese insurance companies are going to sell assets around the world in the United States and other places to repatriate funds in anticipation of claims. And we already see some of that happening. The yen has actually appreciated a bit against the dollar since the earthquake. In the Kobe earthquake that you mentioned earlier in the show, there was a lot of selling and a big appreciation of the yen. But at that point, the United States and Japan were also having a trade war. So I think that the effects through that channel will be attenuated this time around. On the broader issue of the impact on the world economy, we're going to see some shifts in asset flows and investments as everyone adjusts. But one of the
what
things
does that, mean?
That has been
– What does that mean?
Well, simply that they're going to be selling some stuff. There are going to be people buying into Japan. As I think it was David mentioned, this is a buying opportunity with the stock market going down in a panic. I mean, there's going to be some shifting around. But in the broader question that you ask about the global economy, the main threat to the global economy right now in the recovery has been the rapid rise in energy prices. And this, I mean, obviously nobody wants to see this happen through the channel that it's happened. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I don't want to at all be seen as making light of the situation in Sendai. But world oil prices have now weakened.
Because Japanese demand is down? Because Japanese capacity is down?
It's anticipation of a slowdown of economic activity in Japan, and so world oil prices have actually weakened. And so, oddly enough, this event has a disruptive impact on the world economy through the supply chain channels that we've been discussing. It's actually having a positive impact, at least in the very short run, in terms of pushing down oil prices. In the longer term, as they begin the rebuild, that's actually going to pull commodity prices for all sorts of things. One of the earlier callers mentioned steel, but you'll have all sorts of building materials and so on prices getting pushed up over the medium run as they start to rebuild.
David Griffith, do you expect other nations to step into a supply chain vacuum that Japan's problems might right now might leave? I mean, we're hearing about a huge percentage of world flash drives and semiconductors and all the rest made in Japan. Will we see China, Korea, I don't know, the United States stepping up to fill that capacity? Do they have the means to do that?
Yeah, yes, they do, actually. This morning you saw out of China that a number of the manufacturers were actually stepping up production. So you're going to see those opportunities when they present themselves, and the corporations will take advantage of it. As Marcus was talking about earlier, you're looking at multinational companies who have facilities throughout the world, and they're going to pull on different resources, and they're going to ramp up production in one area to supplement challenges in another. And I think that's what we're really seeing right now.
We've got Australia now, the latest news in, advising its citizens in Japan to consider leaving Tokyo. French citizens with no reason to stay in Tokyo being urged to get out or go to southern Japan. Dan in Georgetown, Massachusetts is calling. Hi, Dan. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
I think the these earthquakes that are happening There's many-fold increase in the amount of large earthquakes annually just in the last decade. You know, NASA is confirming that in the next few years, we're going to get much more solar activity from the sun. And currently, our electromagnetosphere is breaking up in large areas. This is just newly discovered in the last few years. So I think the volatility on our planet from now in the next few years is really increasing, and this is extrapolating over the years. The Earth is going through, as it moves, not only through the solar system, but in conjunction with the Milky Way, we're moving through the equinox, and then this is this Mayan calendar thing. Well, people think it's a conspiracy or whatever. I mean, it tracks our movement through the equinox.
Dan, you're moving beyond my expertise there, but let me take that and just put it to my guests. I mean, David, Marcus, you can hear within that a real concern, sort of that's global. It's bigger than Japan about, you know, where the planet stands. There's elemental issues of confidence here that go to investment. And when the third biggest economy in the world is shaken, in this case by earthquake and tsunami, it does go to confidence whether or not you've got the Mayan calendar on your desktop. And I wonder, David, how you see that. Is this enough to shake? Do you see a kind of a rising issues around confidence required to do the investment necessary to keep everything rolling here?
I see the confidence there, but I think Dan's point is well-founded. I mean, if you look at solar flares and the predicted increase in solar flares, there are issues that that's going to create for our communication system, which will affect our supply chains and how we actually are able to ensure adequate inventory issues. You're looking at the changing ecosystem to some extent. That's going to change potentially food prices. We've seen food prices being, you know, driven up slightly also because of the underlying energy increase. So I do think that there are larger, I guess, geophysical issues that we are taking into consideration. But it is an issue of how do we push forward and maintain optimism so that we can continue to deliver value to consumers.
Marcus, you spoke earlier about Japan's government and Japanese confidence in that government hinging in part on how it responds to this challenge. I mean, many people are saying that Japan is in a big enough hole now between its debt and now this terrible disaster that it may have to, as it has in the past, see real cultural changes in order to respond to this, a more open economy perhaps, a more entrepreneurial economy. Do you see this pushing Japan's very culture into a new phase, or maybe going the other way, back to old strengths and truths to sort of tough it out in the face of a very tough challenge, Marcus?
Well, I think they're going to tough it out. But the political point is whether it really affects the structure of Japanese politics itself. Japan has had a set of awkward arrangements since the end of the American military occupation in the early 1950s. It is nominally a democracy. There are elections held in Japan. But for most of that period, it's been a democracy of a very odd sort where one very non-transparent political party completely dominated the political scene, and there really wasn't truly open, transparent competition for political power. That began to develop in the last 20 years after the bubble burst and urban voters and eventually even some rural voters got concerned about the amount of money being wasted on these white elephant projects. And so now you have this kind of novice government in power. If they can do well, that could cement a two-party system. And then Japan would start to have, for lack of a better term, more normal politics and a variety of issues. David mentioned immigration. I could add to that the military and defense policy. All kinds of issues that have been sort of, I don't want to say swept under the rug, but have been not been confronted in a very forthright manner, might then, you know, be put on the table. If it goes badly, if this becomes a kind of Hurricane Katrina moment where the government is seen as really incompetent, then I think the voters are going to flock back to the LDP, and we're going to be back to sort of the status quo ante of most of the last 60 years, in which, you know, Japan is governed by a set of experienced hands, but it is it doesn't it does not seem to have the full flavor of a modern industrial democracy.
David, I wonder what kind of rethinking you anticipate may come out of Japan in the aftermath of this catastrophe. We heard the other day the mayor of Tokyo talking about this being a kind of judgment by the heavens on Japan's greed. I'm not sure exactly what he meant by that, but maybe he was thinking of all the power needed from all those nuclear power plants, one of which is now in such peril. Can you see Japan rethinking in the aftermath of this quake and everything that's come with it so far? I don't know how it does business.
I think that there is a need for Japan to rethink how they do business and rethink the structure of the overall citizenry, if you will. I do think that there is an
That's
immigration
a big statement.
Issue.
What do you mean? Oh, immigration issues?
I think that there's an issue with immigration. As Marcus mentioned earlier, the Japanese population has peaked, and so you really have a graying of society to a very strong extent. And the question is whether or not Japan will move from its more traditional closed stance in terms of immigration to a much opener stance and therefore allow a younger population to come in and revitalize the Japanese economy.
Well, our listener is listening closely. Bill says he lives in Japan. He's been there 19 years. He says he feels very strongly the Japanese will pull together and get back on their feet. Here's another from Eros saying, the fallout I'm worried about, she writes, is not economic. And certainly all our minds today on the crisis Japan is still struggling with, the nuclear threat in particular, and all of our prayers and hopes for the best possible outcome go to Japan right now and the Japanese still in the teeth of this crisis. David Griffith at Michigan State University, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
And Marcus Nolan at the Peterson Institute in Washington. Thank you, Marcus.
It was my pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.